So this is an interview with Dr. Roswell Boutwell in a conference room at the top of McArdle Laboratory. The date is June 3rd, 2013. I'm Molly Loss. So, Dr. Boutwell, I'd like to start by noting that last time we talked, you mentioned that your father was a chemistry professor at Beloit when you were an undergraduate. And so what was it like to have your father as a professor?
Well, it was as though he weren't my father. I had a good rapport with the other chemistry majors, with the students in the college in general, and no one even considered that I was his son, that he was my father. There was no thought in anybody's mind that it would be favored or anything. I was just accepted. He treated me no differently than he did his other students, and I responded no differently than I would have were he not my professor, my mm-hmm. father.
Did you guys talk about it before you began being a student? Was it something you discussed, or was it just understood that you would act as a student?
It was almost thought processes that went back and forth. I just knew that I wanted to be a chemistry major and eventually a biochemist, which he was, because in our casual conversations, little bits and pieces through the years, I realized that this was a very active and stimulating area to do research, that it appeared to have boundless possibilities for research, as opposed to, we'll say, math. Most people think that has limitations. It doesn't really, or physics has limitations, but it isn't in anthropology. But it was more obvious that this science had a lot to do research on, and that is what interested me. And it came slowly and developed slowly in the relationship with my father.
Mm-hmm. I see. So did you have a lot of, did you also have, how many classes did you take with your father?
Freshman chemistry was given by the other professor at Beloit College in chemistry. There were only two professors. And then organic chemistry and advanced organic chemistry were really the only two courses I had from my father.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great, thank you.
I had introductory chemistry and physical chemistry from the other professor in biochemistry.
Mm-hmm.
So I only had chemistry one class each of my 4 years. Otherwise, they wouldn't have counted for graduation. As it was, I exceeded the number that could be taken in chemistry because of the laboratories, and that's why I took more than 120 credits to graduate.
Mm-hmm. And you had a lot of other general education requirements.
So I took so many different, from psychology to anthropology to word derivation, geology. Geology is a subject that you can appreciate for life driving through the countryside. Word derivation, I like a particular dictionary and it has word derivation in it, and I start reading the dictionary when I look up a word and the derivation of the words that are given in the dictionary. So it all broadens your interest in life in general.
Mm-hmm. Did having this broader educational background help with your work as an academic chemist?
Only as it encouraged me to have discussions with my friends. I discussed with Jim Miller, I discussed with people. When you present your ideas to a person, you sharpen them a little bit. And then they come back and the discussion just builds on itself. So that is a great attribute for a person to have, is willingness to discuss and looks for opportunities to discuss. I go to Jim Miller as a graduate student. He had so much more chemistry than I did, and we got to be friends in our freshman year. We ate lunches together every year until he fell in love with Betty Miller, who so in our senior year, Jim and Betty took my place in his life, and yeah. Then some.
Mm-hmm. So.
And you can turn this off for me.
Okay. All right. So you mentioned also that you had E.B. Hart and Conrad Alfvén were your mentors in graduate school. Can you reflect a little bit on what it was like to have them as your professors?
Well, Alfvén was certainly sharp. He knew his biochemistry. He knew it better than most, and so I could come in with a presentation of data, come into his office, and immediately he'd sense what I had accomplished, and he said, "You could make that point much clearer by presenting it in this way." That was the sort of relationship I would have with Professor Alfvén. With Professor Hart, he was called professor, and as a result, most of the professors in biochem were called professors rather than doctor. Hart went to, in those days when he was young, it was the only way to get an advanced degree in chemistry and biochemistry was to go to Germany, to go to Europe. And unfortunately, his wife died not while they were in Germany, but he became ill, and he had to come back before he finished his studies. Actually, Hart was head of the department when my father was in the department. And to my knowledge, that really had no influence on my relationship with Professor Hart. But Professor Hart was in his last year before retiring next to his last year, I'm not certain now. I think it was his last year. And so he would come in and sit down in a chair in the lab and just talk to us. And you had a real good relationship with a person like that, that had the time, and there was no pressure on him anymore to get work out and published and so on. So he could relax and talk to us and give us a perspective on life, on whatever he might think of. So that was an excellent relationship that people often don't have with their major professors. Mm-hmm. That's why I had two, really, was because Hart was at the end. And
okay. Great. Well, thank you. So in the previous interview, we talked a little bit about your research interests as a graduate student. And I'd like to know a little bit more about how you decided to work on the topics that you did when you became an independent researcher.
What determined the graduate student's research in the biochemistry department, at least some of the professors, they would have grants. And Hart and Alfvén had a grant that had to do with fat nutrition. And one aspect of fat nutrition that developed after a year or two after I began was that there was a strong economic pressure to make skim milk and therefore get butter and then put a vegetable oil, which was much cheaper, homogenized into milk. And so that was an important part of the program after the first couple of years. But we dealt to begin with the degree of hydrogenation of the fatty acids, the degree of unsaturation, the length of the carbon chain, the long chain fatty acids being harder to digest, generally speaking. It was that sort of thing that they had research money for, and so that was where I did my research.
Mm-hmm. So when you began to be at liberty to choose your own research projects, how did you decide what to work on?
So I decided I'd work on the subject that the grant that paid my salary was based upon. All of $60 a month.
Uh-huh.
And that was the standard amount of money for a graduate student.
Mm-hmm.
You'd live on $60 a month, you'd live on $1 a day for food, and maybe $4 a week for rent.
So how about when you began at McArdle? What did you first work on, and how did you decide what to work on?
Well, coming to McArdle was similar to my graduate experience in biochemistry. Dr. Rush had gotten one of the first grants from the American Cancer Society. It was called the Committee on Growth that assessed the value of applications for money from the American Cancer Society. Dr. Rush proposed a program on nutrition and its effect on the incidence of cancer. So when he heard me give a lecture, and I didn't know he was in the audience, I didn't know who he was, and heard me give a lecture on fat in nutrition, that eventually raised his interest, because they already had some fat studies going in carcinogenesis, the chemical cause of cancer. So stop. Dr. Rush was interested in nutrition in cancer in general, not just fat. And I had a large background in nutrition in general. In order to do research on fats, you had to know something about nutrition of carbohydrates and proteins and vitamins and minerals. And so when the question of the influence of nutrition on cancer arose, Dr. Rush thought of biochemistry. Potter and Miller were already part of his department, and they had come from biochemistry. And so he knew that that was the place to go. He'd heard me give a seminar. He talked to Rush, to Potter, and to Miller, and they knew me and the background of nutritionists in the biochemistry department, and so that was what I came for. So I didn't have a question in general of what I was going to work on, but in detail I did.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the first things I did was work on fat. Well, I even before that, I just worked on nutrition in general, and calorie restriction had already been found to be protective against cancer in animals, and people had studied research, life insurance policies of people and how they died and what the state of their health was based on weight when they applied for insurance policy. And they found out there was a relationship between overweight of people and dying of cancer. So that was pretty well established. But many of those studies were done simply by taking, say, a rat chow diet that everybody would buy at the store to feed to their dogs. They'd feed it to rats, and then they'd feed less of it to get calorie restriction. Well, they didn't just restrict calories, they restricted protein and minerals and vitamins and everything else. And so one of the first things we did was take the diets that were developed in the biochemistry department, where a particular polysaccharide, a high molecular weight starchy compound that contained only glucose and was purified, not made like the starch from bread that could carry vitamins and minerals along with it. It was highly purified carbohydrate, and we'd use that as a predominant, a major component of our diet for our rats and mice. And we'd know that they'd need about 18% of casein, and that would be casein that was purified of all possible vitamins and minerals. So that was purified. And then the minerals were put in according to something that had been worked out in biochemistry is only about 4% of the diet, and synthetic vitamins were used. So everything was known. So in order to get a reduced calorie intake, we'd reduce proportionately the amount of sugar in the diet of that polysaccharide, that starch component, and the amount of protein and fat and minerals and vitamins was constant. And so we had a great improvement, and we could, on what had been done by most previous studies. And that was my first experiment and the first publication in in McArdle was based upon that. Mm-hmm. And then we went on to study there are a number of things that are affected in an animal's metabolism by calorie restriction. There was a researcher by the name of Sellier up in Canada that had thought that calorie restriction was a mild stress, and physical activity and to a great extent could be to an excess could be a stimulus of a small stress. The adrenal cortex responds to stress, and the adrenal corticoids are increased, but those facts weren't really well developed at that time, and so we did an experiment where we measured the weight of the adrenals of animals on calorie restriction and compared it to those animals that had all they wanted to eat with these good diets that I have described. And it was found that in proportion to body weight, the adrenal of the calorie restricted animal was considerably greater ratio of body weight to that of an animal that had all it wanted to eat. The adrenal wasn't activated, it was just coasting along. And so that was a clue that we published on and pursued in future studies. Mm-hmm. Also, our animals are, and we use mostly female mice, because they don't fight each other the way male mice do. We used skin cancer. I'll diverge a little bit here and tell you why we use skin cancer in mice. Skin cancer arises from the epithelial cells in the skin, and epithelial cell cancer accounts for about 80% of human cancer. The breast cancer arises mostly in epithelial cells, most types of breast cancer. Colon cancer arises in epithelial cells in the colon. It's common to most types of cancer. And so it's a good cell, a good type of cancer to study in general, because it's apt to be applicable to all types of cancer. Mm-hmm. So and one of the advantages of doing your research with epithelial tissue is that you can apply the agent that's going to be a carcinogen that you're searching for. The first carcinogens that were found were really discovered in people. And for example, the smoke, the soot, was discovered, and therefore the cyclic hydrocarbons were discovered as carcinogens by the fact that chimney sweeps got scrotal cancer, and that's from not taking baths and living in this dirty life of a chimney sweep.
Yeah, late 18th century London, right?
Yeah.
It's an older thing.
Yeah, that's an old discovery. Well, skin cancer is easily seen, and mm-hmm. whether it's people or mice, you see what's happening. You work with liver or colon or some other kind of cancer, you don't see it develop in response to your carcinogenic treatment. So you can do dose, and you can be quite quantitative, and you can measure the time to a tumor development. With respect to your treatment, extent as well as time, whether something is powerful or not, whether a lot of tumors result, whether it's dependent on dose of a carcinogen. You can do quantitative studies so much more easily and accurately using epithelial tissues, and therefore it's just ideal for nutrition studies.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the point of my being here, my choice of research. It just has tremendous opportunities. Mm-hmm. Well, for another thing.
May I ask what agent you used as a carcinogen when you were inducing cancer?
The carcinogens that were best used were benzpyrene and dibenzanthracene, mm-hmm. some even more effective than benzpyrene. The polycyclic hydrocarbons that were discovered with respect to the early studies with skin cancer in people, and those were the carcinogens to use, and we could detect which carcinogens were most effective per molecule of carcinogen given, per amount of dose given. And so we could pick a good carcinogen with a good activity response, so you could get a response that you could measure in a few weeks' time. And it was found that if you wouldn't get tumors, tumors both benign and eventually malignant, tumors, unless you gave a heavy dose, you wouldn't get the malignant tumors. A small dose, and it'd take a long time to get tumors. And the difference was the amount of damage that was done to the skin. In addition to everything else, to get cancer in a hurry, you had to cause damage. For example, x-rays, what married couple was it over in Germany in 1895 discovered x-rays?
The Curies.
That's right, the Curies. And that was in 1895. And 5 years later, they found out, they discovered x-rays and they had the physical means for developing them, a glass, blown glass device and all. I can't explain it all now. And the physicists then began to want to study x-rays and how to make them more and less, and they'd hold their hands up to the x-ray machine. By 1902, there was a report in one of the German medical school journals that in among all these wounds, there was cancer in only 7 years after Curie's discovered x-rays. It was discovered that it caused cancer, but it had to be at the high dose. And we now know that people that live to be 95, like me, have had lots of x-rays for maybe a broken rib and something else, TB. You had lots of x-rays in your life, and you still live to this ripe old age and not get cancer. There's a dose response to everything, and it shows up beautifully with carcinogens like the polycyclic hydrocarbons, as in our mouse skin model where we apply it. Mm-hmm. We can get the dose response, the time response, and all that.
On that note, were you ever worried about handling or using these carcinogens?
Well, a little bit. The carcinogenic hydrocarbons fluoresce with ultraviolet light. In applying it to mice, for example, you hold them by the tail and you have the thing that you're measuring the amount of hydrocarbon with your right hand, and you're holding it with the tail of the other, and it's dissolved. The polycyclic hydrocarbon will be dissolved in acetone, which is quite unique. In your control, you can give acetone all day long to the mice and you don't do much damage. So the mice, when that acetone solvent hits their back, which we've shaved this hair off to get bare skin, it evaporates quickly and makes a cooling effect, just like coming out of swimming on a windy day. It feels cold. And they shake. So some of that acetone-bearing hydrocarbon would go on the back of your hand, and I'd taken ultraviolet and I could see these spots fluorescing on my hand. And I thought, well, I should be wearing rubber gloves or something, but I didn't. And yet the dose was so small that I don't even have these are hemorrhagic spots where you bump your skin. It happens in older people. Mm-hmm. But I don't have any dark spots or any spots of tumors at all. The doses were too low.
I see. So I'd like to maybe talk about how your research interests evolved over the course of your career.
Well, there is another thing that we could see in these mice and that is of interest, and that is that the female mice that were on low-calorie diets lost estrus. They weren't fertile. But if you injected them with an estrogen, it would cause the cells to multiply. It wasn't the cells that were influenced, it was the ovaries themselves. Just as the adrenal cortex was affected, and the metabolic effects of that change in the adrenal cortex, or the change in the ovary, or the change in the thymus, all of these things can be changed by calorie restriction. And we could differentiate which ones were important to cancer or important to cancer in the particular organ that might be affected. by calorie restriction.
Mm-hmm.
So calorie restriction can be shown to be effective in mice that are genetically susceptible to cancer, and calorie restriction works there. And then more recently, calorie restriction has been shown in people to be protective, and it has been for many years really now,
mm-hmm.
To against congenital errors in human DNA initiate the cancer. We know from now our present knowledge of DNA and all, and then obesity and even trauma, and we'll come to that later
mm-hmm.
on. Somebody can be in an automobile accident, get thrown against the steering wheel, have terrible damage, mammary gland damage, and other damage of one sort or another will lead to people thinking that trauma, wounds affect cancer, even scars on human tissue can bring out cancer, but only if they've been exposed to carcinogens or have a genetic predetermination for cancer.
Mm-hmm. So did you work on this question in mouse models related to trauma?
We worked ultimately with some people in clinical fields with these issues, and with what we found out, which I'll talk about later, what carcinogens do to mouse skin, mouse epithelial tissue, and then with human tissue in tissue cultures experiments, the same things will be true with the human tissue. But I'm getting ahead of my story a little there.
Okay. So I think we were at talking about calorie restriction in mice, and so what
well, and then what we the things that what did calorie restriction do to an animal's metabolism? And through the adrenal, we thought about adrenal corticoids, and adrenal corticoids we found prevented cancer. And so you could apply actually, when we made those discoveries, cortisone, the corticoids, had not been stimulated yet, and all that was available were adrenal extracts, and they were very expensive because you couldn't get much adrenal extract. It was very expensive, and so our experiments were fairly limited to carry out and prove that correlation for a few years, but eventually that was clearly shown that adrenal steroids prevent. And I'll digress a minute now and say that one spring vacation I was invited to the University of Arizona, where one of my PhDs was head of the cancer research program at the University of Arizona. And so during spring vacation, his graduate students stayed in there, and I'd have a class with them every day along with their research. And so on Easter Sunday at the end of of the vacation, we went for a walk up a mountain, and I didn't come prepared for a hat because I had grown up with outdoor activities as my recreation. I'd gotten naturally tanned and relatively resistant, but I was probably had pure white bald head, and out in that high altitude hot sun, no protection, I got sunburned, and I was going to meetings and riding on airplanes and so on. Mm-hmm. Looked like I had the skin disease. What is it?
Where you have the skin all over
your body.
Yeah.
Goes bad. What's the name of that disease? Where people are isolated in those communities all by themselves.
Leprosy?
I looked like I had that disease.
Leprosy?
Leprosy. You have no idea how terrible wounds they had.
Yeah.
Well, now...
Can I ask what year was this trip to Arizona?
I can't tell you from memory now just when it was, but it was after... Dr. Bowden had gone down there to Arizona and had advanced to the point where he had responsibility for all of the graduate students in cancer research, not just his own, but all of them, and that was what I talked to. So it was relatively recently.
Mm-hmm.
We could say 1980, but I don't really know. It may have been a little further ago. I was still working, and I retired in 1988. It could be the early 1980s.
Mm-hmm.
And so now I get malignant and benign tumors on top of my head, and used to go to Moe's place, and they'd chop out the benign tumors as well as any malignant tumors by surgery. But not the complete Mohs surgery, just scalpeling, Then the dermatology department became a little jealous of the Mohs clinic because they were taking all the people with benign tumors and they wanted those people to come to dermatology, and so then I went to dermatology, and they'd use solid carbon dioxide to freeze off the tumors, both benign and malignant. But about every 6 months, you'd have to go back and get that done again, and after a couple of years of that, I said, this is foolish. They do it so cold that even your brains, I think, get frozen.
Oh.
When they freeze out the skin, just goes through your skull, you can feel it, the cold, something fierce.
Mm-hmm.
So I started using cortisone on my head, and now you wouldn't know. There's a few benign tumors you may be able to see back there, but the malignant tumors haven't come for 2 or 3 years now because I'm using.
That's interesting. So actually, it leads to a question I was going to ask you about how, really looking at your research, you seem to be working on questions that affect people's daily lives, like their diet or the kind of chemicals they come into contact with. So how did your research affect the way you lived your life yourself?
Well, there was this issue that you could paint pie benzpyrene to the skin of a mouse for his lifetime if the dose was small. A lot of people say, well, there's no minimal dose to a carcinogen. Well, there is.
Mm-hmm.
At least it's only a rare mouse that will get a tumor with a lifetime of a very low dose of benzpyrene or any of the carcinogenic hydrocarbons that are more powerful than that. And you attribute that to either spontaneous errors that aren't corrected in DNA proliferation, or the fact that we're all subjected to a certain amount of X-ray to ionizing radiation, and most of those defects are corrected, and so generally speaking, there's in my experience, effective minimal dose of of all sorts of carcinogens. And so there's a question of what Baron Bloom was the person that pioneered in this over in England. He found, he first tried putting cotton pledgets, pieces of cotton into boiling water and putting that onto the backs of mice, irritating them that way, all sorts of irritants. Finally, he found, eventually he found that croton oil was the most effective irritant that he could apply. So we went to work with it and almost discovered that the tetradecanoyl formol acetate was the active material of croton oil, but it was discovered to be the active component by a friend of mine in Germany, that what the active component was, and we began using that. But when Baron Bloom first started those experiments many years ago, I went to Jim Miller. This is back when maybe there were only four professors in, four faculty members in McArdle, and said, gee, how can something that irritates the skin and practically in a lifetime doesn't cause any cancer, how does it bring out cancers after it's just a single, relatively small application of a skin carcinogen? Well, Jim says, I don't see how a non-carcinogen can do that. And so I decided you've asked why did I pick particular research. That seemed like a real positive thing. And while I kept busy with all sorts of nutrition studies I could do with that purified diet, the individual B vitamins or all of the B vitamins as a deficiency instead of just one, all sorts of experiments to decide what was important in diet in protecting from cancer. And certainly the B vitamins weren't. The fat was the main. You could feed four or five times as much fat to a mouse per day and have that mouse be calorie restricted, and you get just as beautiful calorie restriction experiment, whereas a low diet, but calorie restriction not in fat, calorie restriction, how am I saying this? I'm not putting it right. Where they get just a little bit of fat, they'd still get cancer. But if the calorie restriction was right, you could give them a lot of a diet with a lot of fat in, and they wouldn't get cancer. So it wasn't fat, it was calories.
It's interesting. So again, kind of returning a bit to this question of, your research touching on aspects of daily life, was that something that was interesting to you?
Very, very interesting. And that was when we began to pursue what it was in this irritant that combined with a non-carcinogenic dose, essentially non-carcinogenic dose of carcinogen, we get tumors in a hurry. And we finally, of all the things, it took quite a few years, made the discovery that ornithine decarboxylase that makes the polyamines, putrescine, spermidine, and spermine, was the critical issue. Jim and Betty Miller would find that when they investigated their rats, since they couldn't see the liver tumors that they were producing, they wanted to see how the dose or the thing they were studying had an effect. They did a laparotomy, opened up the rat and looked at its liver and used a glass rod, stirring rod, to move the various parts of the liver around to investigate, looking for the effect of their carcinogen. And when they cancer tissue is quite easily broken up into cells as opposed to standard tissue, they call it friable. And so there'd be some in the mice that had liver cancer when they did this, there might be some liver cancer cells on the stirring rod, on that glass rod, and that would rub against the wound cell, the skin wound cell, that cells of the skin wound that they had made when they opened the rat up. And the tumors, liver tumors, would show up on the healing skin wound for a short time and then die off. They were dependent, the life of those tumors was dependent on the environment in which they were present, they were found themselves. And that environment was rich in the polyamines. Quickly growing tissue is high in polyamines. That wound tissue that's healing animals that are first born or as an embryo, they're richer in polyamines than normal tissue. And that gave polyamines were first discovered by a German around the turn of the century in the salmon sperm. And that's where they got their name, putrescine, spermine, spermidine. That's when those chemicals were discovered by a chemist just interested in the chemicals that were in some natural product. And he was approaching it as a chemist and not a biochemist. But that was what led to eventually finding that in all environments where rapid cell life should take place, was high in polysaccharides, in polyamines. So then we went back and did the experiment with the corticoids. Again, when we could do it all with purified chemicals, with a complete understanding of what was going on with the induction of ornithine decarboxylase, and found that yes, the compounds, the adrenal steroids that inhibit skin tumors, skin cancer, also inhibited the induction of ornithine decarboxylase, which we associated as being essential for cancer, and this was further proof that it was. And then we did experiments where we thought we were doing rational experiments rather than just looking for protective agents or causative agents for cancer out of the clear blue sky. We thought it was rational to test retinoids, the vitamin A compounds that determine the health of skin. It's one of the functions of the vitamin A in humans, mm-hmm. in animals. And so we found that vitamin A protected animal because it prevented the production of ornithine decarboxylase. And then because this began to be a subject that was interest to other people, a company that was interested in this for monetary reasons discovered that the Forbol
So tell me about the logical process of going from looking at the retinoids to this other compound.
Yeah, that's the approach that we used, the rational approach. The retinoids were rational, and it would be rational to use something that was a specific poison for ornithine decarboxylase. So the principle had been established years ago that fluorine was a small atom similar to hydrogen that could be put into a molecule that was an enzyme attacked. And so by putting that fluorine, it would prevent that enzyme from attacking, because that fluorine stayed with the compound in question and wasn't released as hydrogen was. So putting fluorine into ornithine was logical. And a pharmaceutical company was doing that because for other reasons they wanted, the medical community wanted to poison ornithine decarboxylase and slow down growth that way. But we wanted it specifically here to stop the growth that was connected with skin cancer, epithelial cancers in general. And so we had the difluoromethyl, the difluoro compound of ornithine that the pharmaceutical company discovered. And that was a charm. It really prevented it. But also it was toxic.
Mm-hmm.
And the level between toxicity to the human and its preventive was so close that I didn't want to do it, but Dr. Carbone insisted on doing it. I said I'd rather do it with vitamin A. Well, he wanted to do it with something that was specific.
And this is the clinical research with Dr. Carbone.
Yeah, it was started with Dr. Carbone.
Yeah.
And it was started between the two of us and his crew, clinical postdocs that would do the work. And then Dr. Carbone had a relationship with one of the Far Eastern countries' medical schools, and he'd go over there once or twice a year and help them considerably. And he was playing golf over there in the Asian country when he fell dead of heart attack on the golf course. And so the project of using the fluorinated ornithine to inhibit tumors was delayed. And in the meantime, then I retired. But also in the meantime, Dr. Verma, who had worked on this prevention of cancer problem, worked on the fact that ornithine decarboxylase was important, had gotten a professorship, assistant professor or associate professor in the clinical cancer in Dr. Carbone's department. And so it was logical for the clinical clinician that was working with Dr. Carbone to go to work with Dr. Verma on this, because by this time, soon after he died of a heart attack, I retired. It was logical for those two to continue it. But it was two or three years of work before they got it going again, and it was, they were all happy with the data. It was prolonged for a long time. And by the time Verma and this clinician studied it, other people had studied it, the fluorinated compound in humans, and found, yes, it did inhibit tumors that were being studied, but it also was so toxic that it wasn't practical. Mm-hmm. And it was sort of after the fact, and when Verma and Dr. Carbone's follow-up person published, it had already been published, and it was a dead issue because it was too toxic.
I see. But this is it's an interesting example of research that you did, basic research in your lab, that gets brought into the clinical sphere.
It certainly came into the clinical sphere, and aspirin, as well as vitamin A, other things we found to be preventive,
mm-hmm.
Have come into practice in clinical,
mm-hmm.
but it was done empirically, more by luck. People studying
So I'd like you to reflect upon what you consider to be your most significant research findings.
Well, probably the most important impact of our research in recent years has come with the discovery that the polyamines must be elevated in the cancer cells, in the cells themselves, the normal cells, as part of the cancer induction process. They must get an increased level of ornithine decarboxylase, an increased level of polyamines. And if that production of polyamines can be stopped, you will stop the formation of epithelial cancer, which is the tissue of origin of most human cancer. And that certainly is important, that reaction can be blocked in animals, can be blocked in people, and that can block cancer.
Mm-hmm. Good. Well, thank you very much for your time. And